I laid there all day, every day. That's how I lived, and that's how I assumed I would die. Did you ever hear a more hopeless statement? That to me is kind of like the epitome of hopelessness. I laid there all day, every day. That's just how I lived, and that's how I was going to die. Welcome to IBC for our cheery message about Jesus helping hopeless people. And that's what this is all about, is hopeless people. Jesus helps hopeless people. A couple of years ago, a guy named Alan Dutchman wrote a book entitled Change or Die. He did a study of the five major issues in the American healthcare system. People, you know, bad patterns that you know, basically will kill them if they don't change. He identified the five things as basically too much smoking, too much drinking, too much eating, too much stress, and not enough exercise. Those are the five things. Sounds like what Alice says to me often. You need to change or die. He identified those five areas of necessary change in the health patterns of people that are choices and whatever, if they're going to get well. And then he cites several studies that show that 9 out of 10 people, when confronted with this question, are you willing to change these five things instead of dying? 9 out of 10 people say no. They are unwilling to change. And they just kind of die. Not right away. But they enter into a posture of hopelessness in their life where, because they think they can't change, there's nobody to help them change, they might as well just make the best of a bad situation. And they enter into a hopeless journey through life. Good news from this passage this morning in our series from John on the light is that Jesus helps hopeless people. And I just want to go through this story with you. I want us to see that Jesus is here to help hopeless people. And then after we go through the story, I want to make two observations. And then I'm going to sit down and shut up. Deal? Verse 1, John chapter 5. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by 5 covered colonnades. This is really interesting. When we led our IBC Israel tour about a year ago, we went to this very place. The Sheep Gate is a gate in the ancient wall around Jerusalem, and that's where people would bring their sacrificial sheep to be offered on the temple courts, which is just up the hill from here, and they would wash their sheep and then take them up to be offered as sacrifices. That's why it was called the Sheep Gate, and right inside the Sheep Gate is the Pool of Bethesda. Now, that is an Aramaic term, Bethesda, that means actually house of mercy. Which is kind of interesting, because those sheep, if they only knew what was going to happen to them after they got washed in Bethesda, I'm not sure they would agree that this is a house of mercy. But Bethesda means house of mercy. It was a pool consisting of 2 pools side by side, with a wall in between the 2 pools and colonnades of porches around all 4 corners and then on the wall. This is a huge pool. They washed the sheep, but they also warehoused the useless people. The useless people. The people that didn't matter. The people who couldn't change. The people who had entered into a hopeless posture in life in which they were just waiting to die. Jesus comes to this pool, and the way John writes it, he made a beeline. I mean, he went back to Jerusalem, which means going south, right? He went north into Galilee, and now he comes back to Jerusalem through the south, probably not through Samaria again. He'd already fulfilled his mission there in John 4. But he comes back to Jerusalem, makes a beeline for the sheep gate, goes right to Bethesda, the house of mercy. Why? Because he was after somebody. He was after this guy that was lame. Verse 3, here a great number of disabled people used to lie. The blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. I just find it very interesting how John describes the people there. He uses two general terms as bookends. He says they're disabled, and then there's one guy who's an invalid. Okay, disabled and invalid. And then in between, he gives us three specific categories, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. See, I think those specific categories represent all kinds of physical and emotional and relational breaking in people's lives. And over all the top of it is this general term, the disabled, who by virtue of the fact that they're disabled are invalid. They're invalids. They are invalid. These are people that in that culture were considered worthless. The Bethesda had become a warehouse for the worthless, which is to say, the hopeless. Here a great number of disabled people had come. One guy there for 38 years. He was an invalid. He was an invalid invalid. 38 years. You know another time in the Bible when 38 years pops up? A little Bible trivia here. Anybody know? 38 years. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Moses is leading the children of Israel out. Egypt, they've escaped and they're on their way to the promised land. They have a few little bumps in the road that required 38 years of wandering in the wilderness. From Kadesh in Egypt when they started their exodus to the promised land to the brook Cherith, which is right on the border of the promised land. They spent 38 years in the desert. I put all that together with this one guy, and I think, here's how he must have felt. I can't change. I'm paralyzed. Therefore, my disablement has made me invalid, worthless. And I actually probably deserve the punishment of being here by this pool. Just like the children of Israel deserve to wander in the desert because they were disabled in their faith. You see, this is how culture, this is how people, this is how you and I tend to look at ourselves when we become disabled through any number of means. We start to look at ourselves as invalid people who are kind of useless and kind of worthless and who therefore don't matter to God and who therefore probably deserve the desert in which we find ourselves. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt that kind of hopelessness? I have. I think we all go through seasons of hopelessness in our life. The biggest season of hopelessness for me started back in 2009 in July when I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. One day I was setting up a tea time and the next day I was in surgery. And started into 2 years, two major surgeries, 32 weeks of chemotherapy, all kinds of unmentionable things that they did to me. I'll mention them to you later if you want to know. It was a time of hopelessness. When I was first plunged into that situation, I felt like I think this guy must have felt. Disabled. I'm not going to be able to probably do ministry anymore. Probably not going to be able to live anymore. They only gave me an 8% chance of survival. And I just felt like, man, disabled, out of the game, useless, invalid, and probably deserve the desert that I'm going into. I felt that way. I think that's how all of us feel, whether it's a diagnosis of cancer, or whether it's the loss of a business, or the breaking up of a marriage, or the estrangement of children, there is something that happens to us whenever we realize that something is missing in our lives, something is broken in our lives, something that has changed in our lives that makes us hopeless. I felt it. I can understand exactly what this guy is feeling like right there, who is a disabled person, invalid for 38 years. Verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want me to cure you?" No, that's not what he asked him. He asked him, "Do you want to get well? Do you want to get well?" Now, that's a jarring question in the circumstance, don't you think? Doesn't that surprise you? Here Jesus is. He makes the beeline from Galilee. He comes all the way to Jerusalem, comes around to the northwest part of the city, the old sheep gate, to the pool of Bethesda, to the house of mercy, where all the invalids are warehoused. And he comes up to the guy, probably, who'd been there the longest. Hard for me to believe that anybody else had been there for like 39 years. And the question he asked him is not about being cured. It's about hope. It's about hope. Do you want to get well? Your heart has been plunged, very understandably, into this season of hopelessness because of your disablement and your marginalization by the culture. Just want to know, do you want to get well? Do you want some hope back? You see, Jesus, I think, completely understood what the problem with this man was, problem with me was, problem with all of us who go through seasons of hopelessness is. The problem is that we lose hope. And when we lose hope, we begin to adapt to our hopelessness. You know, some people think, you know, I've never had a season of hopelessness because we think hopelessness is a season of despair where I'm just wringing my hands and I can't get out of bed in the morning because I just have no hope and I'm just so despair. Here's the insidious thing about hopelessness is you tend to get good with it, right? You tend to kind of adapt to it. And that's what Jesus saw that this man had done. He had adapted to his hopelessness. That's why his question wasn't about being cured. His question was about hope. Do you want to get well? Do you even want that? Now, I'm not getting down on this guy by the pool. Man, I just went through, you know, weeks and months of hopelessness. This guy's 38 years there. I actually admire this guy because he had taken a terrible situation and had adapted to it. I think that shows initiative. I think it shows courage. When his hope died, he adapted. He adapted. How did he adapt? Well, I think he started making friends with all the other misfits in the warehouse there by Bethesda. They had their own little community. They started a newsletter. They got a seat on the city council. They became an interest group. I think he scoped out in 38 years. He knew where the sun was, where all the good shade was at any point in the day, in any season of the year. And I think he'd ordered like a really nice mat from Orvis online so that he had the Cadillac mat to lay on all day long. He knew where to put it in the shade with his friends. They knew how to do life. They knew how to eat. They knew how to survive. They had adapted in their hopelessness. And that's the most insidious thing about it is they weren't in despair. This guy wasn't in despair. even though he was sunk in hopelessness. Then he explains to Jesus why he'd lost hope in the first place. Verse 7, "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." This poor guy's, he has learned how to manage his disability in such a way that it's actually become to him a lifesaver. You see, the pain in his heart that started as hopelessness, "I have nobody to help me. I have nobody to help me." That pain in his heart is what he had to manage and adapt to overcome. And so he'd actually made his mat an asset in his survivability. It was a lifesaver to him, sparing him from the continuous pain of believing that he had no one to help, ever. But that's where he was wrong. That's why Jesus traveled from Galilee down south to Jerusalem. It went right through the sheep gate, went right through Bethesda in the pool, the house of mercy. He went right to this man. And whenever this guy said to him, "I have no one," I think Jesus gave him a look and said, "Yes, you do. You have me. I have no one to help me." Jesus looked at it as if to say, "Yes, you do. I have come to help you." After my first surgery, the bad diagnosis of survivability, oh man, they started me in on a course of chemotherapy that was really gnarly. And I just kind of went into this mode. I can't believe this has happened to me. There's not much hope that I'm even going to be alive, much less make a contribution anymore. I have truly become disabled and an invalid. And I spent a little time adapting to that. I got to be really good friends with hydrocodone and Vicodin. My doctor even issued me a prescription for medical marijuana, which I never filled, but I still have. How long are those things good anyway? I still have it. You know, I started to make adaptation. Okay, this is how my life's going to be for a while, if it lasts for very long, and so I'm going to make the best of it. And then Jesus, "When I whined, I got nobody to help me." Jesus said, "Yes, you do. Me." You say, "Pastor Andy, how did Jesus, did he like show up?" Yes, he did. He showed up through his body, the body of Christ. If you weren't here in those years, there was this pager. Those of you who just laughed, you know about this pager. Staff basically got one of these old-fashioned pagers, and you young people, you don't even know what this is. This is old technology. But you dial a number, basically, and it would ring this pager. I got all these, and so basically the staff gave this pager number out to the whole church and to all our missionaries and to people basically all around the world. And they just said, "Pray for Pastor Andy, and when you pray for him, just ring the pager. He won't know who you are, but he'll know that somebody just prayed for him." That crazy thing went off 24/7 for 2 years. I am not exaggerating. I had to take the batteries out of it at night so I could sleep. I'm serious. And you know what? Every time that pager buzzed, I heard Jesus saying to me, Yes, you do. I got nobody. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Verse 8. Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and he walked. Kind of interesting, isn't it, that Jesus gave him that command, which was on its face impossible. Here's the guy laying there for 38 years. The one thing he can't do is get up. And yet that's the first thing Jesus tells him to do. Get up. You see, I think Jesus was asking that man to trust in him. Here you have the Son of God, Jesus Christ, fully God, fully man, forever united in one person. He is saying to this man, from my sovereignty as one who has come to help you, I am telling you to do the impossible. What you cannot do in your own strength, the Son of God, I'm commanding you to do. And if you will say yes to that, then I will take you all the way home. See, I don't think Jesus cured him and then he decided to get up. I think in a microsecond, that man trusted in Jesus. And when Jesus said, get up, I think he said, okay, I will. And in that second, when he started to try, Jesus healed him. Get up. Get up. I want to make two observations. The first observation about this story is very simple, but I think it's the most profound and important observation that we can make. And it's about Jesus and hopeless people. Here's the first observation. Jesus values and loves hopeless people. Hopeless people matter to Jesus. They didn't matter to the culture in Jesus in the first century. They don't matter in our culture now. We're not as valuable as hopeless people, as people who are powerful and strong and capable. The same way today as it was back then. The world doesn't value the disabled who become thereby invalid, deserving the desert. The world doesn't value. But Jesus does. Jesus does. And if you're hopeless here this morning, if you're a disabled person, if you have been put in terms of your hope for the future and to be used by God and to experience a joyful and productive life for the kingdom of God, if you have written yourself off this morning, you need to hear this. Jesus hasn't written you off. He loves you. He values you. You matter to him. That's what we learned from John 5 when he went straight to Bethesda, the warehouse of misfits. He went straight there. And he went straight to the guy who was the most hopeless of all. Why? Because he had outrageous love for all people and especially for those who are undervalued. You need to hear that. Because there's a lot of you who, like me, are going through a season of hopelessness, or you soon will. And the first conviction that will leave your heart when you enter into a season of hopelessness is that Jesus still loves you. Don't forget, he does. I don't have anyone to help. Yes, you do. You got me, Jesus said. You mean, Pastor Andy, even if there's something major in my life that is broken, Jesus still values me, still loves me? Yes. Even if I've got cancer and the chemo is killing me, even if I suffer from anxiety and the attacks are terrifying me, even if the addiction is strangling me and will not let me go, even if my bipolar disorder with its mood swings are just paralyzing me, yes, he still loves you. You mean, Pastor Andy, even if something in my life is missing, something big is missing in my life, he still loves me? I still have hope? Yes. Even if the soulmate that I've longed for has never showed up in my life, even if my father was never there for me when I was growing up, even if infertility has seemingly denied us a family, even if we have a family and our children are grown and estranged from us, yes. Wait a second, Pastor. Even if something has changed in my life and not for the positive, you're telling me that Jesus still loves me, that he still values me, that I still matter to him. Even if the business I spent my life building just went bankrupt, yes. Even if the church I gave my life to pastor just asked me to leave, yes. I have a dear friend that just happened to. Even if that moral failure of mine destroyed my reputation, yes. Even if my spouse just divorced me, yes. Even if I look up one day and I find myself, I've grown old and placed on the shelf, yes. Things change in our lives. There are things missing in our lives. There are things broken in our lives, all of which consign us to the warehouse of hopelessness. And what we need to understand, what we need to hear is Jesus still values you and has a plan for you, and you matter to him. And all of that leads me to the second observation. The first observation is Jesus values hopeless people. And the second observation I just want to make is that Jesus asks all hopeless people to do three things to get well. Okay? Three things to get well. Get up, he says. Get on up from there. Get up. What's that a command of? I would submit that it's a command to trust. It's a command to believe. There was nobody at the pool of Bethesda that day that knew better than this man how incapable in his own strength he was of fulfilling that command. It was a liberating command in a way because he realized that Jesus was asking him to trust him. I'm telling you to get up. Trust me. If you say yes, you will. Trust me. Trust Jesus. Trust in the Lord, the Son of God, who came to help the helpless. The guy did. He took Jesus as his word last week, Craig's sermon. Took Jesus at his word. And he trusted in Jesus. If you're stuck, if you're hopeless, if you're in that place where you have made a successful adaptation to your hopelessness so that it's not despair, but it's actually things are going along pretty good, even though all hope is lost, are you willing to trust Jesus when he says, I can make you well? Get up. You willing to trust him? Maybe some of you who have never trusted him before, even as your Savior, you've never humbled your heart. You've asked him to forgive you of your sins and to bring you into the forever family of God by faith. Are you willing to trust him for that? And if you have done that, but you're still caught in a hopeless web where you have adapted successfully and you're living your life, you can't change, you know, so you're just going to die. Are you willing to trust him? That's what all that with the pager did for me, you guys. You guys are responsible for this. I'd had a major surgery. I was taking chemotherapy, and I was new to it. I'd never had it before. And I was pretty low. I felt terrible, sucking on ginger mints and trying to keep food down and trying to stay awake. And Jesus says to me, get up. Don't sink. I don't want you accommodating your life now to hopelessness. I don't want you successfully adapting to hopelessness. Get up from there. Basically, trust me. I'm with you in this. You're not alone. I'm here to help you. Will you trust me? So I got up. Jesus said to me, get up. I said this very profound word. Okay. Okay. I trust you. Jesus says, pick up your mat. Get up, trust me, pick up your mat. Pick up your mat. What is the mat? The mat represents all the props and excuses that that man had grown adept in using to cover his passivity and to adapt to his hopelessness. And Jesus said, no more. Pick that mat up. Scoop that mat up. That mat that has held you down, I want you to show mastery over the mat. Get rid of the excuses, get rid of the props, and scoop up that mat. You master it. You get rid of the excuses, you get rid of the props. I call that mat scoopage. Jesus said, I want to see a little mat scoopage here. And for me, when I was going through all that, you know what that meant for me? I was using a feeling nauseous and weak and all my hair going crazy and other unmentionable things that were going on, which I write about in the book if you want to find about. It's kind of humorous, actually. I used all that as an excuse to kind of just sit by the pool every day, passive. And I heard Jesus saying to me in those days, look, pick up the mat, stop making excuses. What can you do? What can you do in the middle of this? The only thing I felt like I could do is write. And so I started writing. Do you know? That book, Notes from the Valley, that I wrote after the cancer adventure, a major portion of every chapter in that book was written with a chemo pump on my waist. Pick up your mat. Find something positive. A recovery group to join. A ministry to serve. People that need your help. Stop making excuses. Get up from there. Pick up your mat and walk. Move one day at a time into a hopeful future that is not hopeful because you're convinced now that, like if you've got cancer, that Jesus is going to heal you. I never had that promise from him. I did have a promise that if I get up, pick up my mat, he would be with me and he would make me well. My heart, my outlook, my perspective, he healed me. And I took it a day at a time and lived my life. And I never had the assurance that I was actually going to be physically cured. But I had been healed. I got well. It's kind of a nice icing on the cake that he actually cured me later. But the fundamental healing was in my heart. Get up, pick up your mat, and walk into a hopeful future. This is what Jesus wants for all of us who are hopeless. We made a video about an IBCer who did just that. And I'd like you all to celebrate with me Nellia's story as you see it on the video.